We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program. We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director today, Jason Croft, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Dr. Mark Agronin says his view of aging has been transformed by his patients. Dr. Agronin is a geriatric psychiatrist. So if a geriatric psychiatrist can have his ideas about aging transformed, what about the rest of us, whatever our age? Dr. Mark Agronin joins us to address that question. We'll find out what he's learned about aging from his patients, stories he tells in his new book, How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. Listeners, I look forward to hearing from you. Your questions and comments are invited. Here's how to be part of the discussion. Give us a phone call or send us an email message. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Mark Agronin is the psychiatrist at Miami Jewish Health Systems and an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. In 2008, he was named Clinician of the Year by the American Association for Geriatric Psychiatry. His book, How We Age, is published by DeCapo Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, and the email address will-talk@illinois.edu. Dr. Agronin, good morning. How are you?
Very good, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's my pleasure to talk with you. So what led you to geriatric psychiatry?
When I was in medical school, I always gravitated towards the oldest patients that I worked with and was assigned to. I found that they had a perspective on illness, on their lives, that was truly unique. And I also loved the stories that people had to tell me, the history that they witnessed. When you're working with a patient and find that it's somewhat like a good mystery, older patients have even more complex and amazing mysteries to work with. So it was just a natural fit. And I knew I wanted to go into psychiatry, so the two things just came together.
Yeah. But on the other hand, you know, you open this book with this story of being in medical school where you say the training comes with this lesson, aging equals death, and later another lesson is layered on top of that, aging equals dementia.
Well, it's true, and I think symbolic of this paradox that we find not only with the aging process, but I certainly found as a doctor in training that the exposure you have to older individuals is often pretty dismal. Individuals come into the hospital with some of the most complex medical issues, many medications, social problems and issues. And so you put that together, often, especially for the young doctor, it doesn't give a very positive impression of aging, and it echoes a lot of the societal views we have of old age being about decline and decrepitude, and basically being a pretty miserable time of life. And yet, I had to contrast that with the richness that I also saw in the older individuals I worked with. Once you really delve in and get to know them and get to know the situations. And I would say, thinking about growing older, that at the same time we see the loss and decline and changes that are an inevitable part of growing older, we also see what people gain as they age. I always pose this question to people. Think about how you made decisions when you were 18, and now think about how you make decisions when you're older. And when do you think you make better or more informed decisions? And most people universally say, well, of course, when I get older. And I say, well, that's exactly the point, that there's so much we gain and we continue to gain regardless of age. And this is one of the most important points that I want to get across in the book and through the stories in the book.
Yeah. You begin the chapter, Heaven Can't Wait, with a story about a woman recently widowed after 73 years of marriage. Now, talk about trying to delve into someone's story. You have to approach it openly and then be prepared to listen. Would you tell us the story?
Sure. Well, the average age that I treat is around 90, and many of these individuals I see in the nursing home where I spend a lot of time. This is actually the largest nursing home in Florida. And I was asked to evaluate a woman in her 90s who came in after her husband passed away, and all I was told about her was that she had been married for over 75 years. Her husband passed away only about a month prior to coming in, and she simply couldn't take care of herself. When I heard the story, I really was filled with sadness, and I imagine that this woman has to be terribly depressed and upset. How is she going to cope? Not only is she in her 90s, now she's in a nursing home, but her life partner has been gone. And so I walked in the room and I sat with her, and I looked at her and I asked her, what has it been like for you after so many years to face such a loss? And she looked up at me and simply said, heaven. I did not expect that response, and she saw me do a double take, and she explained to me very quickly that this had been a very gruff individual. She said, well, I stayed with him because of the kids, and I said, well, how old are your kids now? She said, well, they're in their 70s, and I began to realize that what I envisioned for her, my assumptions were completely wrong, and it just reinforced this message to me as one of her doctors, and a message I'm certain we all need to absorb for when spending time and thinking about our own elders, is to let them define aging for themselves. Don't make assumptions about what it has to be like for them, because often it's wrong. And if you look at a lot of studies about late life, if you look at surveys of older individuals, we find time and time again that what people are saying and experiencing is often vastly different from what we imagine, especially the negative that we imagine.
Yeah. It's so hard to let that part of our ego aside, though, because, you know, we're bringing ourselves into a situation with another human being, and it's really hard to let ourselves go and put it all the effort, the spotlight on them.
It's very difficult, especially when we're young. And I use the term young and knowing that can be defined in so many different ways. I work with individuals in their 70s and 80s who still consider themselves young. But we tend to project oldness onto other people. And we think it looks a certain way, it has to act a certain way. And you're right, it's hard sometimes to get out of our own impressions and assumptions to really listen to someone. What I found in my work is I've been forced to do that. I when I'm sitting with someone and trying to understand what's going on, I realize that part of being empathetic, which is not only the job of a psychiatrist and a psychologist, but it's something we all have to cultivate in our relationships. But empathy is not just about imagining what someone else's experience is like. It's also about just listening and taking in and letting them define it for us. So it can be difficult, but in the end it gives you such a deeper appreciation of someone else.
Mm. You say the problems of aging should be weighed against the promises. What are those promises?
Well, think about the following. As we get older, we have more knowledge and experience than we've ever had in our lives. And this touches into the question I posed earlier about how our decision-making changes, and most of us would agree is better as we get older. Emotionally, we tend to be more mature as we get older. A lot of research has looked at the way in which our minds think about day-to-day experiences and make decisions. We tend to be more practical. We have a broader perspective. This is something that, in many ways, has been called wisdom. And we even find as we get older that our sense of well-being improves. There's a very frequently cited study from the Gallup organization a number of years ago that looked at well over 300,000 individuals age 18 to 85 and looked at levels of well-being. And what they found is that we start off pretty good at age 18 and we decline and hit a low point about middle age, around our 50s. And then our self-reported well-being increases and actually peaks around age 85. And that comes as a surprise to a lot of people. But put together, what this tells us is that as we get older, we retain an enormous potential for experience, for knowledge, for wisdom, for maturity. It's something that we can cultivate and look forward to. And later life can be a time of opportunity and potential as much as it can be a time of change and loss for so many individuals. It's not about painting a false portrait of it. And believe me, in my work, I see really the worst-case scenarios. But it's about realizing that getting older is not just something that happens when you turn 80 or 90. It's something that happens every single day. And trying to find meaning and potential in our lives is a lifelong process. And when you think about the elders around you, consider the riches that they have and what you can learn from them. And this is also, I have to add, what drove me into this field, growing up with so many elders that left such a deep impression on my own life, and realizing that age is what gave them those strengths, not what took them away.
Why do you suppose, then, we have, as a culture, a dread of aging?
Well, it's a youthful fear of death. We equate aging with death, and this is perhaps why I opened up the book talking about my experiences in Gross Anatomy, because as a doctor, the very first week of medical school, already the old person you're working with is lying on a slab in front of you. So we all have a fear of death, which changes over time. But we really equate that with aging. I think that's part of it. And it's also changing over time, because from a generational perspective, if you turn the clock back 30 to 40 years ago, when you turned 70, that was pretty old. The lifespan only 100 years ago was about 50. It's changing so quickly that I think perspectives of aging not only have improved dramatically, but will continue so. And when you think about the fact that this year, the first of nearly 77 million Americans, baby boomers, are turning 65, over the next 20 years, that enormous group is entering later life, we really are going to see a transformation of what it means to be older, and it will be viewed, in my opinion, as more so as a time of vitality and potential than a lot of the negative images that we think about and encounter today.
Yeah, and the parents of the baby boom generation have really blazed the way.
They have. If you look at the greatest generation, which is still with us today, they certainly have blazed the way and have really made an enormous difference. To me, working with these individuals is such an amazing experience. Still with World War II veterans. Down here in Miami, I work with a lot of war survivors and a lot of Holocaust survivors. And so I hear about the very worst that our civilization can do, but I also see in these individuals the very best.
Tell us about Joseph Redhair.
Before I came down to Miami, I've been down here a little over a decade. I did some training in geriatric psychiatry in Minnesota. And so a number of veterans that I work with at the hospital were from the Lakota tribe in South Dakota. So Joseph came to me. Actually, I make the point that he's one of my youngest patients. He was in his late 50s, early 60s at the time. He had been a Korean War veteran, suffered from severe alcoholism. When I saw him, he was really experiencing severe symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, which we're seeing a lot of in older individuals in the VA at that time. And I struggled because, on the one hand, he was visiting with a medicine man back at the reservation, and then he was coming to see me as a psychiatrist, and I really felt inadequate compared to the medicine man because I didn't know his culture very well. and I had to learn a lot about him. And in the end, he ended up dropping out of treatment, just saying the post-traumatic stress symptoms, the PTSD symptoms, were too much for him. And I thought about that for so many years. It bothered me. I always wondered what happened to him, and he was one of my first patients and during my training, and did I fail him? And when I was writing the book, I wanted to tell his story, and I decided to track him down, and I did. And it was so wonderful to find out that as he got older, he matured, he was able to not only get over both his alcohol problem, but PTSD, but actually become a counselor for other individuals. And when I spoke to him, he had gone back and purchased his ancestral land. He was raising buffalo on it and was now serving as a tribal elder. It was a wonderful way of seeing how late life for someone brought resolution and brought new strength. Mm. And so for me, that's such a central theme of the book that I just had to tell his story in it.
Yeah. Well, as I read that story, this question came to mind. I thought, I'm going to ask Mark Agronin this question. What role does hopefulness play in aging well? And then throughout the book, as I went along, it becomes very clear how important it is.
I find at so many moments working with older individuals, especially since they come to me with severe psychiatric problems, sometimes hope is the only thing you have sitting on the plate in the moment. Think about someone who's a war veteran, a Holocaust survivor, someone who, like the woman we talked about, who lost her husband after so many years. When you're facing someone who's had a profound loss, whether it's physical or psychological, it can be a feeling of powerlessness, of not knowing what, if anything, can be done for that individual, and thinking that age has really robbed them of any opportunity. So again, hope might be the only thing you have, but I found as a doctor it becomes one of the most precious tools, not only for the individual to help them cultivate that, but also for the doctor. And sometimes very surprising things can happen, and you use hope as a way to bridge the gap between treatments, between an idea of what to do for someone, because in the end, being there for someone is doing something, and that can be very, very powerful. And working with older individuals, not only do I find being there for them can be helpful, but I get as much out of it. And I tell anyone, if they say, well, you know, what advice do you have in terms of working with older individuals or older people in my family, I always say, really get to know them. Sit down and tape record or videotape stories, experiences. It's amazing what you will learn from someone who you might not have thought has a lot to offer.
How do you cultivate hope?
Well, I found through listening to someone's stories, to listening to their life experiences, you realize that what they faced at one point in time, they were able to find a way out of. They were able to cope with and find a solution. And so when you see that, you realize that there's always that potential to make change. I would say I've seen this most profoundly in war veterans and Holocaust survivors. I talk about in the book one particular woman that came to me literally for maybe a 15-20 minute assessment. I think we ended up sitting together for about 3 hours. Because she began to talk about her experiences during the war. She'd been in Auschwitz. And I asked her, I said, your experiences indicate that you could have been killed at any moment. I mean, how do you wake up every single day knowing that this could be your last day? You've lost everything. How do you have hope in a moment like that, in a situation like that, not just for an hour, for a day, but for years? And it was really remarkable. She said, well, she was a religious woman, so she said, I had faith, and I believed in God, and that was something that really provided a rock for her. But she also talked about the connection she had even in the concentration camp. There are a number of young women from her hometown that she was with, and she said, I have to tell you, we clung together, and when they had to do hard labor, if one couldn't move that day or one had trouble, they would help her. They would hold the shovel, move the shovel for her. They clung together. And knowing that they had other people, those connections, for her, made all the difference. That gave her hope. And to me, that was a really profound lesson, because I realized sometimes when people come to us and there's really nothing else sometimes we can do other than just be there for them, to have a connection with them, that that is doing something, and that gives people hope. Mm. And when we realize how powerful that can be, it can really transform a situation. And from that standpoint, it doesn't matter how old someone is, whether you're 80, 90, 100, you can always make connections like that.
This is Focus. Our guest this morning, Dr. Mark Agronin. He's a board-certified adult and geriatric psychiatrist. He is the psychiatrist at Miami Jewish Health Systems, and he is the author of How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this morning with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. There are plenty of problems that come with old age. One of the toughest situations that I'm recalling from the book at the moment is about Rosa and Alberto and their son. Would you tell us about them?
Because I work in a nursing home, the majority of individuals that I see suffer from some form of dementia, which is a brain disease characterized by memory impairment and impairment across all other cognitive skills. Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia, and I would say in any given nursing home, at least half, if not more, individuals are suffering from that. So with this particular family, Rosa not only suffered from dementia, but had really extreme behavioral changes. She was extremely agitated, almost nonstop at times. And her husband and son were struggling with this terribly. They loved her dearly. For her son, this was not only his mother, but his savior. When they left Cuba when he was a little boy, he really saw her as spiriting him out of the country and saving him from oppression there. So he was more than dedicated to his mom. And so seeing someone you love so much not only suffer from memory impairment, but then act in such an agitated and aggressive way was extremely troublesome. Both of them became very depressed, which is common in caregivers, more common than we see amongst their peers who are not caregivers. And this case came to me, and I didn't know where to turn. I tried everything I could imagine. Nothing seemed to work. She seemed to get worse with treatment. It was a real dilemma. There's so much talk today about the use of medications and excess medications when people get older. But when you face a situation like this with someone so agitated to the point where it's almost impossible to care for her, you have to do something. And if it's not a medication, the question is, what else do you do for someone? So this was a really an extraordinary case, and as it turned out, it got to the point where I think all of us really felt that we didn't know what else to do. We threw up our hands. We sat, we worked together, we met, and I ended up proposing something which I've really only done once in the last 10 years, somewhat unorthodox in this case, but suggested we use what's called electroconvulsive or shock therapy. Thinking maybe this is a severe case of bipolar disorder or severe depression superimposed upon her Alzheimer's disease. And as it turned out, it worked, and it worked miraculously. She really came out of the state she was in. She still was suffering from memory loss, but it was a world of a difference, and I saw really a transformation. And I think what that case taught me, and this is a point I always make to caregivers, is that you just can't give up. There's always different therapies, different treatments that can be considered, and it's difficult to be persistent. It's easy to think you've hit a wall, but again, this is where hope plays a role, because here we needed not only hope, but I would say hope plus in a situation like this. This is really challenging. But also what I found is just working together, those connections really made a difference too. It got the family through the difficult period of time. And I have to say, as a doctor, it really transformed me in the following way. It's easy as a doctor, especially when you work in geriatrics, to over time become somewhat fatalistic about individuals. Obviously, people get conditions that they're simply not going to recover from. And when your mission is to heal people, you get to the point thinking, well, there's nothing I can do, and so it's time to pull back, it's time to withdraw. What I learned as a doctor is quite the opposite. When you get to the point like that, there's always things you can do. That's when you have to be at the bedside. You can't abandon the patient or the family. You have to be there for them. It's not about always finding a cure, and sometimes it is being there with someone in the family in the last moments, but that's also part of the process, and that's a responsibility we have to our elders, because in essence, by giving them that, we get it back ourselves, and we get back, you know, enormous riches ourselves.
Mm. So it sounds like patience also plays a role in terms of finding a way.
Yes, especially with the older patient, because things either can take place very slowly or they can happen in an instant. But you have to be ready for change, and you have to realize that things will happen on their own timetable. And this is where maintaining involvement and connection is so key. Unfortunately, we don't have enough people going into geriatrics. And when you think about the way our population is changing, demographically, the percentage of individuals who are 65 and above is increasing rapidly. The fastest growing segment of our population is 85 and above, and yet we simply don't have enough individuals going into geriatrics. So that's going to be an increasing area of need. But it is true that it's a challenging area to go into, and you do have to have extra patience when working in that area. But it is an enormously rewarding field.
So it's tough, but it's rewarding. So why don't we have more people going into the field? And why don't we have more people going into psychiatry?
Well, part of it has to do with medical training. And nowadays, students come out with such enormous debt and often gravitate towards higher paying areas of medicine, that have a little more glitz sometimes. And geriatrics and psychiatry is not necessarily in that area. I think that's part of it. There might not be the same financial incentives overall. But I think it also taps into the way we look at old age from a larger perspective in society. And as I talked about in the book, the training for most medical students often exposes them to the equations of old age being equivalent to either death or dementia. And so it often gives them too much of a negative perspective. So that might be part of it as well. But without question, we also need more resources to go into geriatric training. And when you think about it, the third biggest killer now is Alzheimer's disease. The third most costliest disease state right now is Alzheimer's disease, and it's only increasing. And if we don't declare war on Alzheimer's disease the way we've done it with so many other disease states, we will find ourselves in an increasingly difficult and costly situation, not just personally, because this afflicts all families, but as a society as well.
What about the fields that would involve the study of aging? What happens when we age? What happens in Alzheimer's? Where are we in terms of encouraging people to go into those fields, and are people going into those fields?
Luckily, this has changed over time. What I found so interesting is when writing the book, I interviewed some of the early and leading researchers in aging. And they all told me the same thing. They said in the 50s and 60s, if you went into geriatrics, it was almost considered professional suicide because there was very little funding. And if you were at a university, it was not going to get you a lot of attention. Certainly wasn't going to earn you the type of accolades that most academics need to focus on. And so it really was a backwater area. It didn't change. In fact, research into Alzheimer's disease didn't really start coming into its own until the 1980s. So luckily that's changed. And the reason it's so important is a point this was made to me by someone named Gene Cohen. Gene Cohen passed away a number of years ago, but was really one of the founding fathers of geriatric psychiatry and even of modern geriatric research. He told me this fascinating story. Because I asked him, how did you get involved in the study of aging? And he told me about when he was a high schooler, in New England, he entered a science contest, and he figured out a way to determine the age of a certain type of fish. And you think, well, what does that have to do with aging? But he said when you knew how old that fish was, you knew everything about its environment, about the pollution levels, about what was going on in the fishing stocks. It tapped into a wider field. And it's the same thing about aging. What's really remarkable is when you understand why cells age, you also understand why, at least you, it gives you a window into understanding why certain cells don't age, those being cancer cells. And so you can see that the study of aging can tap into some really fundamental scientific questions that we have that have enormous implication. In fact, there's just a couple years ago that one of the Nobel Prizes was awarded to a team who did work on cell division and why certain cells can essentially become immortal, certain cancer cells. And this all derives from some early research done on the aging of cells. So this is why the field is so important, and luckily more people are looking into it.
Mm. Somebody pointed out to me a few days back that MIT has an age lab now.
Yeah, what they put together, this is so interesting, is they've developed this suit that you can wear that makes you feel like you're older. It limits your movements, it limits your sensory experiences, and so it's a way to almost induce what it's like for some people when they're in their 80s and 90s and above as a way of testing out technologies that can help individuals overcome some of these. So really innovative work being done, and they know, just as anyone who studies demographics knows, that our population is aging. And not only is it aging, but the elderly now are more active and more involved than ever before. They will be more activist than before, and so if you're developing new products and technology, that's going to be a huge growth area in the coming years.
Mm. I like to think about that, and I also like to think that 85 could be a peak year for me.
Well, what's fascinating is for some people is I have to tell you, when I give talks on the book, it's most, in some ways for me personally, challenging when I have an older group. Because I stand up them in front of them and I say, I'm going to talk to you about aging.
And you're only 40-something.
And I'm in my mid-40s and they're in their 80s. And I say to them, what can I possibly tell you about aging that you don't know already? But one thing I always do, I say, so I want to ask you this question. A lot of people tell me that aging is tough and that it can be an awful time. So I say, well, what do you think? You tell me. Don't let me define it for you. What do you think? And universally in the groups, and these are groups in nursing homes, in assisted living facilities out in the community, people tell me that it can, that there are challenges without question. If you're in pain, it can be pretty miserable. But that goes for any age if you're in pain, or if you're sick. But they say putting that aside or being able to deal with or cope with that, it can really be a wonderful time, a time of new opportunity and new connections. And I see this as becoming more the norm for people than less so.
Mm. We're about here, a little past the mid-break here on Focus. Our guest this morning, Mark Gronin. He is the author of How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. We'll continue our conversation after a short break.
On the next Fresh Air, getting smarter in the fight against terrorism. Veteran New York Times reporters Eric Schmidt and Tom Shanker talk about new approaches in the battle with Islamic extremists. Hacking jihadist websites, undermining al-Qaeda's message, even playing interactive video games to find terrorists exchanging coded messages. Their new book is called Counter-Strike. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
This is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this morning, Dr. Mark Agronin. He is a geriatric psychiatrist and the author of How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. Listeners, I invite you to join us this morning with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, some people talk of a cure to aging. What do you think?
Well, if the people talking about a cure for aging are usually not doing research into aging. If you ask any mainstream researcher, they all pretty much say the same thing, that aging is a condition of the human body. It's not a disease state, and so there really is not, there's no cure for it. We can certainly live, by living a healthier lifestyle, you can improve the chances of living to later in life, but there is no true anti-aging formula other than if someone invented a time machine, because as Leonard Hayflick makes the point, and he's one of the probably most well-known and one of the founding fathers of a lot of modern aging research, makes the point that there's two forces of nature that we're up against. The first being entropy, which is the property of molecular bonds to weaken and become, to lose their energy over time. And second is time itself. So without being able to reverse these properties of physics, there's really no way to truly have an anti-aging formula. Basically, what people are doing with anything that's called anti-aging is maybe they're making themselves look a little better. Maybe they feel better. But you're not really reversing the aging process. So I agree with this perspective. I think it's the point has to be about living better rather than living longer, per se. I certainly would not take issue with anyone who wants to have us live longer. There's someone named Aubrey de Grey who promotes any sort of research and believes that it is possible to significantly lengthen our lifespan if we're able to get at certain fundamental cellular mechanisms. You know, I'm not so certain about that, but it's interesting. A lot of people raise the question of, if you had the opportunity, would you want to live longer? And if so, you know, what age would you want to designate as your you know, stopping point, in terms of that this is how old you'd be for however many years? Raises a lot of very interesting questions. You think about the implications for society. I just don't see us getting to that point. I think what will happen, if you project into the next few decades, is that it will be routine for people to live into their 80s and 90s and live better, and hopefully without having to face dementia. And when you think about that, it's not unreasonable that in the next 20 to 30 years, if you look at what are the major barriers in late life, it's cancer, heart disease, and Alzheimer's disease. If you're able to control or even cure those three entities, what that means is that when someone turns 65, they will have another 40 or 50 good years ahead of them to be active and productive and not have to face severe debility or pain, at least from those main killers. That will really transform the way people think about their lives. I think the notion of retirement is going to change fundamentally. It will be a time when people want to start new careers or new pursuits or whatnot. And I think that change will come. But I don't think that we will all routinely live to be 130 or 150 or beyond. Mm.
Let's take a call. This is a listener in Effingham on line 4. Good morning.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Within the last 2 years, I have, think I have discovered something that is pertinent to the subject matter here, that the Homo sapien species, which we are, evolves in four stages of three each: infancy, lower, middle, and upper; childhood, lower, middle, and upper; adolescence, the same three; and adult in three. And the world, as I perceive it, And the subject matter today, I think maybe, if you've already talked about it, I'm sorry, but the social aspect of how we live and how we go through those four stages of development and the results of that leads to a shorter life. And if the work of psychiatry and psychology and understanding that and how that should steer how we move life ahead is I'm convinced of that. And I just wondered if you had ever heard of it in those terms. Thank you.
Okay. Well, there's certainly a lot of stage theories of human development. If you look at most major theories of human development, whether it's Eric Erickson or Freud or others, they tend to divide it into the stages, and that touches back all the way to if you views of the Greeks, and even before that, we tended to divide the lifespan into ages, largely having to do with the major maturational changes people face from infancy through young adulthood. I think when you look at the aging process, what changes is when you get to your 30s or 40s for the most part, most of the development that we face has already taken place, and then it's about more psychological changes as we move forward. And in fact, I spend a fair amount of time in the book talking about the experiences I had with Eric Erickson, who was a very well-known psychoanalyst and psychologist in the 1900s, who focused on what he called his eight stages of man, and casting late life as being a time for either finding a sense of integrity or wholeness to one's life, or facing a sense of despair. And I really wanted to set as a counterpoint to that the work of others who talk, such as Gene Cohn, who talks about late life being a time of potential. So with respect to the stages you talked about, I think there are many different schemes, and I don't particularly hold to one or another, but I do like this concept of not being so fixed to it as we get older and realizing that we do have potential which can go above and beyond some of the limitations that we've previously thought about as we get older.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Terre Haute, Indiana. Line one, hi.
Hello. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about gender differences in especially this society versus perhaps other European and Oriental societies and the aging process, and I will hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
There's been a really interesting shift that we've seen over the last 30 to 40 years in terms of how gender roles tended to be relatively fixed. In fact, it was interesting that if you look at some of the work in the 60s when they talked about the stresses and changes that people face as they get older, one particular theory looked at how changing gender roles for men and women, at least in American society, could be so difficult, especially if, for instance, you had an older woman whose husband passed away and now has to take on the role that her husband took on before, or if you had an older man whose wife was suffering from Alzheimer's disease and now had to assume a lot of household chores, and that was looked at as a major stress. I think nowadays we don't focus on that as much. The gender roles tend to be more balanced for the most part, and so I don't see that as much of a stress. Now, that's in most Western countries. If you look at, and I wouldn't say this is necessarily different in a lot of Asian countries, I think it has to do probably in more rural and conservative areas in other parts of the world where you still have very fixed gender roles, as well as roles of older individuals. On the one hand, it does give... It's a more organizing principle for people as they get older, but keep in mind in a lot of those societies, the lifespan is measured more in the 50s and 60s rather than in Western countries where it tends to be a little less than age of 80. So aging itself is more curtailed and looks almost like it did in our country maybe 50 or 60 years ago.
This is Focus, and our guest this morning is Dr. Mark Gronin. He is a geriatric psychiatrist. He's the author of How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800 800-222-9455 if you'd like to talk with us this morning. We also can take email messages. That address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, as the population gets older, where will we live and how will we live there?
If it's interesting when you, if when we speak to our parents and especially our grandparents' generation, that most of them have the experience of having an elder living in the home with them, grandparent or someone. And this often was a wonderful experience. It meant that old age was not something at an arm's length. It wasn't something that took place only in a nursing home or in some retirement community. It was something that was right in the household with them. And they not only had a sobering view of later life, but they also were able to form very deep connections with their elders as well. And this is something that's changed significantly. I think very few families today have an elder living in the home with them. To some extent, there's a lot of segregation. I speak in South Florida, where you have very large communities where it's exclusively older individuals living there. An enormous growth of assisted living facilities, which serve a purpose in that they provide people with extra assistance so they can be more independent, but it also means that we won't have as many old individuals living right next to us and in our community, where those day-to-day responsibilities that we have really enable those connections with them. I think to some extent this is going to become even more so. If you look at the trends right now, there's more of a focus on older individuals living separately, living in different communities. I think on the one hand, it's a positive if you're older from that standpoint, if you need more assistance. But I do think society loses something from that because, you know, then it's you're not exposed to, when you're younger, you're not exposed to older individuals as much. And I think the only thing that may change that is more by necessity, more older individuals will have to remain in the workforce. And this will mean that in our day-to-day jobs, retirement is going to change in terms of the age range, and it will be a more normal experience for us to be working with individuals who are several decades older than we are.
Here's a question I have for you that I suspect a lot of caregivers come across, and it is one that you have come across as a doctor. How do you approach an individual who resists or refuses what seems to be a good course of action or treatment?
This is where getting to know the person is so critical, because you want to know, why are they resisting? Is it because there's a memory issue? And they're resisting because they are not able to understand or process what's in front of them? Is it because they're depressed? Is it because they're fearful of someone trying to exploit them? There's so many different elements that can be involved with that. And my role, at least as a psychiatrist, is to try to understand and to get to know the person before making any assumptions or passing any judgment on that. Because I see this resistance every single day. For some individuals, it's about this fierce desire to maintain their independence. And so I have to play the role of an educator as much as a doctor to explain how sometimes something, and I will give driving as a perfect example, that sometimes someone's attempt to maintain their independence in the face of great risk can really lead to even greater peril and end up shortening their independence. But not everyone has a doctor, a social worker, or a family member that can always explain that to them. And so unfortunately we see individuals who end up in a worse situation because of that. But again, getting back to this, what I mentioned earlier in the conversation about hope, it really comes down to getting to understand the situation on a deeper level, to understand that there are reasons why people do things, that there are different potentials. As a psychiatrist, some people assume that it means digging into their childhood and understanding why they do everything. It's not so much about that. It's simply getting to know a person's background, where they came from, what they enjoy, what's meaningful for them, medically what's going on, what stresses them, And often that opens so many doors, and when you make those personal connections, allows you to work with someone who previously might have been seen as very resistant. And I say this to caregivers because so many adult children now are struggling with aging parents and not always knowing what to do and being frustrated with it. And I always say, get experts involved who work with, not only work with older individuals on a day-to-day basis, but really understand how aging can change the equation at times.
Hmm. How do you deal with stress?
Well, I have to say, I'm very fortunate that I work in an environment I'm surrounded by stress experts. And so we try to really practice what we preach. But I will tell you, related to this conversation, that in the 15 years that I've spent working with older individuals, I have found that these individuals have taught me to be more patient, to realize that when a stress is in front of me, that there are more than two sides to the story or to the coin, and so that means that there are other possibilities, not to look at things in such a catastrophic way, to be hopeful, to be able to step back from something and weigh the different possibilities before jumping in and acting. So I've tried to absorb the wisdom of people I work with. So these are all strengths of the aging process that I found incorporating them into my own life have allowed me to really reduce enormously a lot of the stress. And so that, it again, is this point that aging brings many different advantages and things we can learn from. If you look right now in the media, there's a focus on how do we get an older brain to be like a younger brain? How do we do a brain game or some sort of exercise that's going to make us younger? In this case, I'm saying the opposite. I'm saying our younger brains have a lot to learn from older brains and can help us in so many different ways.
So we want to strive for elder statesmanhood, I guess.
Yeah, you can be wise when you're younger, there's no question. But so much more wiser if you're able to take advantage of all of the knowledge and experience that you have as you get older.
There we have to leave it. Dr. Agronin, thank you very much for talking with us this morning.
It's really a pleasure. I want to thank you so much for the opportunity.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure. Dr. Mark Agronin is a geriatric psychiatrist. He is the author of How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. The book is published by the DiCapo Press.
You can learn from. If you look right now in the media, there's a focus on how do we get an older brain to be like a younger brain? How do we do a brain game or some sort of exercise that's going to make us younger? In this case, I'm saying the opposite. I'm saying our younger brains have a lot to learn from older brains and can help us in so many different ways.
So we want to strive for elder statesmanhood, I guess.
Yeah, you can be wise when you're younger, there's no question. But so much more wiser if you're able to take advantage of all of the knowledge and experience that you have as you get older.
There we have to leave it. Dr. Agronin, thank you very much for talking with us this morning.
It's really a pleasure. I want to thank you so much for the opportunity.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure. Dr. Mark Agronin is a geriatric psychiatrist. He is the author of How We Age, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Growing Old. The book is published by the DiCapo Press.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
It's 2 minutes before noon Central Time, 80 degrees in Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn, and you're tuned to Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. Well, it's time to turn our attention to commodity prices, so let's go to Kansas City and find out how September wheat is faring. It is up 10 cents at 8.21. The December contract is up 10 and a quarter at 8.45 and a quarter. September wheat in Chicago, 729, up 16 and a half. December, 755 and three quarters, up 14 and a quarter. September corn, 711 and a half, up four and a quarter. December, 724 and three quarters, up four and three quarters. March, 738, up five. And the May contract, 742, up four and a quarter. September soybeans, 1340 and a half, down three. November, 1349 and three quarters, down one and a half. January, 1360 and a half, down one and three quarters. March, 1366 and a half, down two and a half. September meal, 350.50, down 150. September oil, 55.05, up 14. August live cattle, 117.70, down 20. October, 120, down 10. August feeder cattle, 135.60, that's down a nickel. October lean hogs, 89.72 and a half, down 25. On to the outside markets, where September crude is trading at 86.75, down 112. The U.S. dollar.